You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
The family at the center of Helen Schulman's new novel, This Beautiful Life, is in many ways enviable. The parents are highly educated, successful, and loving, and the children, who are beautiful, intelligent, and charming, appear poised to continue happily on the path their parents have cleared for them. However, this seemingly invulnerable family is undone by an email sent to the teenage son that contains an unsolicited, sexually explicit video, which soon goes viral. Ms. Schulman explores how the Internet has made the boundary between public and private acts increasingly ambiguous and the difficulty of parenting children who may have never thought about confidentiality as a concept. It is published by HarperCollins. I'm very pleased to welcome Helen Schulman to our show today. Hello.
Hi. Thank you for having me.
Was your initial inspiration the news stories about teenagers sexting and getting in trouble for sending explicit photos?
Absolutely. That was hugely part of it. In about 2003, when my book is set, I became aware of all of this. I'm kind of a late adapter. It takes me a while. But also, somebody sent me an email with a picture of a woman, a bridesmaid, sort of joyously reaching for a bouquet, and she was wearing a strapless gown, and her breasts had popped out. And I thought, oh my God, this in anybody's life prior to this time in the world would have been a private, sort of terrible moment. She'd drink some wine and try to forget about it. And now it was in my inbox. And there was an incident in England where this girl went on a date with a guy and she sent him a sexy email and he gallantly forwarded it to some of his friends. And by the end of the weekend, she couldn't leave her house. So it was all of a sudden these scandals that were containable or somehow you could live through them were now out into the world and on the Internet seemingly forever. And I'd been thinking a lot about the Internet and the earthquake it has wrought on the culture, and
don't say the word earthquake these days.
I know, we were just talking about yesterday's, but this seemed like a good way to get at some of the things I was thinking about.
But it's interesting that you said it in 2003. Today, this is probably even more likely to happen.
Oh my God, it's proliferated so much. You know, I've become, I get little obsessions grow. I've been sort of obsessed with the legislation coming out about sexting. Sexting between adults is legal, but if a minor is involved, in some states it's illegal, in some states it's not a punishable crime. And there, I guess there's 26 states that it's on, they're trying to figure out what the legislation should be right now. And it's proliferating.
So you get this idea for a novel, and then you have to decide what kinds of characters are best to tell the story.
That was really a complicated thing, you know, because with all of this, we hear stories often about kids being kind of very cruel with these and cyberbullying. I mean, to the point where kids have committed suicide. And I was trying to figure out who were the people involved in this. And then I thought, well, I'd like to make them as human as possible. So I picked people and the kids involved as well who I thought were pretty innocent.
And Jake, the teenager who forwards the sexually explicit video, says at one point that something like this could happen to anyone.
I think that's true. I mean, honestly, even right now today, having spent all these years thinking about it, if I got a video like that, it would be hard for me to not forward it to my husband. I mean, I think there's the impulse to share with somebody something that shocks, stuns, excites, mortifies you. It's hard for people to keep a secret, and especially a teenager.
Well, when the novel opens, the family's just moved from Ithaca to the Upper East Side of Manhattan for a new impressive job that the father, Richard, has taken. Couldn't the novel have taken place in Ithaca?
Yes. I think it could have taken place almost anywhere. I had other ideas within the book that I was trying to explore. I was really interested in post 9/11 America. And it's a sort of another obsession of mine, and the rush to greed and leading up to the banking crisis. And that was part of it. And New York was the epicenter for that as well, another ground zero.
Did you want to position them as outsiders in the elite society of the Upper East Side?
There is a fish out of water element to it. They're new. They don't totally get it. I don't think that initially the parents understand how big the guns are that they're dealing with.
And then there is the old matter of classic Greek tragedy. The fallout from Jake's action is more dramatic because of the family's wealth and status.
Well, what happens is that the news media gets involved, the parents are suing each other and the school. The big guns are pulled out, and Jake's parents quickly realize that the way to fight back is big. So they employ the media, they get legal representation, they maneuver. It gets very large. The story is huge, and the kids get lost in all of that.
Richard and Liz, that's the parents, fill pretty traditional roles. He works long hours, and she's a stay-at-home mom, which is a bit surprising for affluent, educated, and politically liberal people, isn't it?
Actually, it's not, which is another one of the things that I was interested in writing about, and this story gave me a means to do it. I'm 50. I grew up in the 70s. I was taught that it was very important for me to have my own career and be self-sufficient economically. And when my children entered school, they were in private school for a while, and I was really, really surprised to see a lot of very, very educated women, women with PhDs and law degrees and MBAs, who had money and choice, and the choice was then not to work. Yeah.
Well, why do you think Liz isn't aware of what's going on with her son, even though she's a really involved mother?
Well, I mean, some of it's just natural. Kids have their own lives, and at a certain point, without you even knowing it, their lives become private, and they exist in a world of kids. I mean, I remember that happening to me as a teenager. And I think she's also, as soon as this happens, she's so overwhelmed by it. She loves her child. She'll do anything to help him, but she gets very depressed and scared and almost phobic, and she retreats.
My guest is Helen Shulman. Her latest novel, This Beautiful Life, is published by Harper. You call Richard the father a golden man several times in the novel, which brought to mind the Swede from Philip Roth's American Pastoral. He also had a child who failed to live up to the promise of the father. Is this an age-old generational story, or does technology create a new playing field for this kind of conflict?
I think technology, it does exactly that. I think it is an age-old story. I mean, the powerful father, the kid who lives in his shadow, kids transgressing, kids, you know, teenagers being run by passion and not thinking about consequences, that's the way it's always been.
Well, at the end of American Pastoral, when the family's falling apart, the narrator asks, and what's wrong with their life? What on earth is less reprehensible than the life of the Lvovs? So what's wrong with the Bergamots, your characters?
The Bergamots are, what's wrong with their life? They make bad decisions and they have lousy choices. And they're trying to figure out the world we live in now, which is what I was trying to show, you know, the way we live now and how complicated it is. And the hugeness, the vast hugeness of the internet and all the good it can do and the bad it can do. I mean,
we have Jake reading The Great Gatsby for school while he's suspended for forwarding the video. Obviously, you chose that book and not any of a number of other books you could have chosen. What's its significance for you?
Well, I think, one, it is a book that you read in junior year of high school. I think it's a book that talks about sort of carelessness, recklessness, greed.
And one of the passages Jake is drawn to is, they were careless people, Tom and Daisy. They smashed up things and creatures and then retreated back into their money or their vast recklessness or carelessness or whatever it was that kept them together and let other people clean up the mess that they had made.
I think that he sees himself and his Daisy that way.
Because you've named the girl who sent the video Daisy.
Yes. I didn't do it that came later. The Gatsby passages came much later. Daisy was Daisy from the moment she was born in my head. But I think that what happens to both kids is that they're never really given a chance to own what they've done and try to make right by it. They're never given a chance to talk to each other. Their parents just sweep it all away in their efforts to protect them. They actually cripple them.
This Daisy is not like Daisy Buchanan, Fitzgerald's Daisy Buchanan. You have another character who is kind of more like her, Audrey. But this Daisy is, she sent him the video to show Jake she's not too young for him to consider as somebody he could date.
Yeah, they've hooked up at a party and she wants to take it further and he says, no, you're too young, and that's what prompts her. But I feel very deeply for my Daisy. I think my Daisy is deprived. I think she's lonely. I think she's eager to connect. I think in her own weird way, this is a gift that she's trying to give him. I think she's very vulnerable. I mean, no one on planet Earth could say what she did was a good idea. I mean, obviously. But I think that there was something in it that is very touching.
Well, usually in stories of this sort, the emphasis is on how the teenage girl was harmed by her exposure. But you focus instead on the impact on the young man who unthinkingly exposed her.
I think both kids really suffer. I think that they're different people and they are made up of different metal, and that Daisy is a survivor just by birth. But I don't think she is not touched by this. I mean, I don't think that, you know, at a certain point she lands a good job because of her father. I don't think that means her life is good.
But she does seem to feel empowered to some degree by this whole thing.
Well, I think
by exposing herself.
It's interesting that that is what young girls are taught now, that by being sexual, very sexually attractive and available, that that's where your power comes from. And I think that, you know, we live in a land where Paris Hilton didn't exist till she had a sex tape and then she became famous. And that's what kids are seeing. And so somehow that's how Daisy thinks she's going to get power, is through her sexuality. Never does it occur to her it can be through something else.
Richard notes that scandals like this once could be dealt with privately and eventually forgotten. But once something's on the internet, it's there forever, isn't it?
Yeah, I think forgetting is over, at least for now, until someone learns how to scrub this stuff out. It's out there, and that's the problem. You can't move to a new town and change your name. You can't graduate and go to a new college. I mean, part of growing up is making mistakes and reinventing yourself and continually reshaping yourself. And I think that's hard when the internet is full of pictures.
But it also allows people to become celebrities, as you said. Well, Paris Hilton was a rather rich young woman. This girl has money, but she's not on the Paris Hilton class. Her father doesn't own a string of hotels. But still, you become a celebrity, and in this case, she becomes a celebrity where people actually ask her to sign autographs.
That's right. And Jake, I think to his own horror and dismay, when he's suspended from school, but he comes back after his father has sort of fixed it for him, he's shocked to see that he's a folk hero. To some kids, he's a pariah, and to some kids, he's a folk hero. And this degrades his sense of self-worth.
His mother, Liz, wonders if making these things public will remove the shame.
I think there's something to that. It's something that I think about. You know, I just read in Time magazine an article by Belinda Luscombe. She was writing about a survey at the University of Rhode Island, very small survey, but I think 56% of the kids who answered the survey said they'd received an intimate image, and then of those 56%, one-fifth admitted to forwarding it. And I teach grad students, but in the summer I teach college students, and talking about it with my students this summer, some said they thought sexting and all the stuff around it was like a media-based phenomenon, but others said it's a big part of their life. And if you meet someone you like, they'll say, well, send me your picture. So, you know, if more and more, if 56% of the kids are sending pictures to somebody, then it's not as shameful as in 2003 when Daisy did this.
You've published a number of novels and a collection of short stories. Could this have been a short story?
Could it have been
Or are there just too many different things to be that you wanted to deal with for it to have been broken down into a short story? Because the germ of it could is very much short story material.
I agree with you. I mean, if you take it to the reductive sense that this is a book about a sexting incident, yes, it could be a short story.
And the fallout from it and who gets blamed.
Right. But I was interested in a lot of other things.
You also question who should be held responsible for something, for the fallout, the video in this case, Daisy, her parents, Jake, his parents, the school. Why is it so difficult to pin responsibility on someone these days?
Well, because it's so complicated. Life is so complicated. We're always trying
to
make it black and white.
But this girl did made a video of herself, sent it to this guy to interest him in her. She's responsible, isn't she?
She has a huge degree of responsibility. And he has a degree of responsibility for forwarding it, and his friends for forwarding it. And her parents have responsibility for leaving her home alone to have this party. And the crimes involved, I actually think, are so much smaller than what happens to them. The punishment is so much vaster that was more interesting to me. I mean, yeah, I wondered about how many people are going to blame the girl, because they always do. But then the girl's been socialized to be this sexual object. So then who do you blame for that?
Is the fallout in part due to the lack of responsibility people will take on for themselves?
I mean, I'm a novelist and I'm not a hypermoralist, but I do think that these kids would have been better served if they were allowed to take responsibility for themselves, yes.
As you were writing this, did your attitudes about this kind of thing change?
Oh, my God, so many times. I had such a hard time ending the book. I think I started writing it too soon, in a way, because the world was changing so much, and the attitudes about this stuff were changing so much. And every day I'd pick up the paper, and there would be something new. And in a way, that's why I had to set it in 2003, so that I could begin to have some understanding of what it meant at that point.
Mm-hmm. Because we're in such a state of flux that if you set it in 2010, let's say, people would say, oh, gee, everything changed yesterday. But if you set it in 2003, it's already a moment in history, even if it is recent history.
That's right. I see it as historical fiction.
Well, the mother becomes obsessed with a former lover's blog. So this is not just something that the kids are engaged in.
No, I mean, and look, we have our own Anthony Weiner, right? I mean, you have the very sophisticated, very smart man, could have been mayor, doing something pretty dumb, something that he knew, he must have known, would easily become replicated and people would see these images. And yet somehow in the safety of one's own room or office, people seem to forget how public all this is.
Although in his case and in some other cases, one which just seems to have been decided not to everyone's satisfaction, it's also about men in power, isn't it? And that is not an issue here.
Well, with him, was it about power? I don't know. You know, it's interesting to me. I'm not a psychiatrist, obviously, but was his about the medium itself? I mean, I doubt Anthony Weiner would have exposed himself on a subway, and I don't think he would have taken Polaroids of himself and handed them out. I think it was something about the freedom of the Internet that allowed him to self-destruct this way.
Do you hope that your novel will spur conversation between parents and teenagers, or do you not think that way when you're working on a novel?
I was not thinking that way when I was working on it. What's been interesting is since it's come out, is so many people have told me they've read it and given it to their kids and talked. And I thought, great. But that was not in my mind when I was working on it.
Well, do you have kids?
I do.
And have you had these kinds of conversations?
Oh, sure. I say, you can't sex because mommy wrote a book about sexting.
It comes down to something that simple?
Oh, no, of course not. But, yeah, what goes on in our family is private, yeah.
Are you interested in exploring the big issues, political, moral questions in your novels? You said you're not a moralist.
I said I'm not a hyper-moralist. Yes, I think about these things all
because
the time.
Because your previous novel is about 9/11.
I'm sorry?
Wasn't your previous novel about
9/11? It was about
9/11.
And I'm very, very, very fascinated by contemporary American life. And I'm obsessed with the news. And it's the greatest theater on earth. and with huge ramifications. It's hard to think about anything else.
Well, different writers have told me about all sorts of things that got them going on a story or a novel. Everything from a smell or something they saw in the sky to an article that they read in the newspaper. Are there certain things that get you going more than others?
Absolutely. I think with three of my books, it's sort of like Henry James talked about the germ. You know, that little thing that you hear, the little snippet of conversation or the story somebody tells or that newspaper article. And then all the things that are swirling in my head suddenly make sense because I have a story to wrap them around. And in a way, the story to wrap them around is not as important as the weather, the emotional, intellectual weather that then gives it substance and heft. But you have to have that story. Otherwise, it's just a bunch of ideas.
So in this case, it's some sensational thing that occurs, but the important part to you is how the families and the community interact.
Yes. I did not set out to write a story of a scandal. You know, I wanted to write about the way we live now.
So what are you working on now? Can you tell us?
I'm working on a screenplay.
Uh-huh.
Of a very short story that I wrote. It's 2.5 pages, so I have a lot to make up.
On the other hand, many writers will tell you that short stories lend themselves a lot better to screenplays than novels because the short story often has enough plot or almost enough plot for a movie, whereas a novel usually has too much and too many characters and too much has to be sacrificed.
Well, it is that kernel thing again. I mean, you need your story. I need a story. I don't know what other writers need, but I need a story.
So plot matters to you.
Oh, yeah. It's a skeleton in which to hang the rest of it.
I want to thank you so much for being on our show. Helen Shulman, her novel, the latest, This Beautiful Life, published by Harper's.
Thank you.